This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
It's a pleasure to introduce Sneha Dave, who is the founder and executive director of Generation Patient, an organization to create and support systems for adolescents and young adults with chronic conditions across the U.S. and internationally. Ms. Dave's team consists entirely of young adults with chronic conditions. Their efforts include advocacy for peer support and collaboration among providers, caregivers, health systems, payers, policymakers, and others, with youth voices being central to transform healthcare to be more holistic, family-centered, and equitable. Ms. Dave will address a key gap in the current system, the healthcare transition of youth and young adults.
Thank you so much for the introduction. And I'm Sneha, and I am a young adult with a chronic condition. I've lived with pretty severe ulcerative colitis since I was 6 years old and a couple of secondary conditions based on that too. And I created what is now Generation Patient when I was 13 years old. It just started out as a small newsletter, and it grew because I realized there was a really big gap in understanding the unique challenges and opportunities for change for this transition period of young adulthood. And given that, we'll be living with these chronic conditions for a lifetime, I felt like it was really important for me to be able to connect with my peers, but also for me to understand what type of resources and tools existed as I was thinking about my future. So I have been running Generation Patient full-time now for 4 years after I graduated in May of 2020 from Indiana University. And we have now 3 full-time staff members, all of whom are young adult patients from across the U.S. So I'm going to talk a little bit, disclosures. These are our grantors, and one important component of Generation Patient is that we've declined all funding from the private healthcare industry, which means that we have tried to really keep our independence from any sort of potential influence of funding sources, especially including the pharmaceutical industry. So the outline and objectives for today is to learn about the systemic challenges young adults with chronic conditions face during the transition to adulthood. And I think one important thing to note is that for this presentation, I will be sharing a little bit outside of the confines of the hospital system and more so some of the policy issues, fundamental policy issues that we encounter outside of this sort of medical setting. So I hope it provides some more context as to some issues that, touch the hospital system, but really impact us outside of the confines of the hospital system. And to gain awareness and understanding of both direct support systems, level opportunities for reform for young adults with chronic and rare conditions. And one other thing I want to note is that our demographic at Generation Patient, we focus a lot on autoimmune conditions. And I think we have a lot of room to learn to be more accessible and inclusive of young adults who live with autoimmune conditions and chronic health conditions and developmental disabilities as well. That's an area that we are trying to, I think, increase our advocacy for and inclusion of. So I'm really excited to learn throughout the day as well as to how we can do that better. So a lot of our focus, as I mentioned, is on sort of autoimmune chronic health conditions. So as you all know, young adulthood is a really remarkable time of transition for young people when we think about financial independence, school, appointments, work, higher education. I think a huge additional one that's often forgotten is that a lot of our community members transition to become caregivers for their parents or adults during this time period as well. And that's an area that we've kind of seen grow a little bit more of our conversation around is what it means to live with a chronic health condition, but also to be a caregiver. And then the last thing I really want to emphasize is this idea of identity and what it means to be growing up and forming an identity when living with a severe chronic illness or being diagnosed with a chronic condition in young adulthood. As you all might know, there are pretty significant gaps in data for young adults, and Part of the reason is because we have not seen young adulthood well defined within both agencies in the United States and globally. So we've seen more robust definitions for pediatrics, adolescents, adults, and older adults, but not so much for adults between the ages of 18 to 26 or 27 to 35, for example. And we believe that that's a huge missed gap, and something that could really impact the way that we think about clinical research or the way that we think about navigating various systems. So, this is the data that we currently have that in 2019, the CDC estimated that over 25 million young adults ages 18 to 34 live with at least one chronic condition. And we did some calculation to think more about like autoimmune conditions and what that looks like. So we know that we're really a growing demographic and one that needs to have more awareness and support. So the work that we do at Generation Patient, I know the slide is a little bit busy and I didn't mean to include all of these words and I don't think they're all relevant for right now, but I would the way that we think about our policy and advocacy work and our support work is through direct support. So we do peer support meetings and we believe in peer support as an intervention in our community rather than just a nice to have service because we believe that the power of peer support can create community confidence, empowerment for realizing one's own potential. And it's not just a peer support meeting, but it's a lot more of thinking about, how can we reduce loneliness, depression, anxiety, because we know there's been some data out of Canada that shows that young adults with chronic conditions are 363% more likely to attempt suicide. And unfortunately, the mental health interventions right now are not fully working for a lot of our community members. So we believe in peer support as a solution to think about improving the mental health outcomes of our community. And one other thing I'll just say about peer support is that our peer support meetings are led entirely by young adults with chronic conditions. And so rather than taking this provider-led model of peer support, we believe strongly in training our community to be facilitators and creating spaces where there's this validation and empowerment of living with a chronic illness. Our research and policy work is also quite robust. We just started doing research in the last couple of years because we want to create that evidence base to be able to inform policy and some of this greater systems change. We're focused on three core issues within research and policy, which I'll get into a little bit later. First, I'm going to share just a little bit about our peer support meetings. We've done now nearly 600 over the last couple of years. We have three different types of peer support meetings that we do per month, two of each. And we're really excited because in March this year, after a couple of years, we're expanding our peer support work with our partners in South Asia and East Africa to hopefully make them a little bit more accessible globally because we've gotten that interest, but just haven't had the capacity in the past. So some of the discussion topics of our peer support work include self-advocacy, compassionate goal setting, disability identity, the fear of missing out, which is actually really pronounced in our community given social media and the fact that oftentimes the only connection that our community has is virtually, and this like passive connection through social media. So it's a big one that we address, coping with unpredictability, and then test results, dealing with that and what that means to cope with these sort of very difficult situations when you don't really have anybody else in your life that can understand what it means to get a negative test result, for example. We also do a lot of work in research and roundtables. So we also, sorry, this slide is very messy, but we believe very strongly in this idea of patient-led research because I think one of the things that we noticed as we were looking through literature, whether that's in the peer support space or in the health policy space, was that some of these research questions were not getting to the root of what we were looking for as patients and the questions that we wanted to have identified and researched. And so we've led a series of roundtables, which lend into our research arm where we bring together healthcare professionals, researchers, sometimes policymakers, patients, care partners, and just a variety of people to try to identify the most pressing research gaps. So in 2023, we had about 8 peer-reviewed publications that we did, led primarily by young adult patients. And these identified areas of gaps, for example, sexual and reproductive health, what adult providers should know about young adults with chronic conditions. And so we are actually replicating this year. In 2023, we did it with inflammatory bowel disease specifically, but now we're broadening it to all chronic conditions because IBD was sort of our test case for that. And then we have our roundtable, which we're on peer support intervention for young adult patients, which we're finishing up a 2-year project this upcoming year. And I think a couple of really exciting things that came out of this roundtable, which we have a town hall coming up for, was the definition of peer support. So we felt the need to redefine what that looks like for our community, because we believe that that would then inform researchers and other people who are trying to think more about peer support at a systems level as to how to really look at peer support from a community-led sort of model. We also have a resource for researchers who are designing research studies around peer support, because we really hope that more of you all as researchers or just healthcare professionals or community members can produce more research in this space, because it's very much needed. So we also have a bunch of resources in higher education and advanced planning, which I will skip over just because of timing. So another area that I really wanted to address, I think, throughout the rest of this presentation is our work in health policy. And I feel like this is the most important to us right now, especially because we have seen just an exclusion of the young adult patient voice within health policy conversations. There's a lot of policy surrounding pediatrics, as there should be adults and older adults, but it seems like we've often forgotten the unique transition challenges of young adult patients. So we are focused specifically at Generation Patient right now on the pharmaceutical industry and increasing access to prescription medications, because through our peer support meetings early on, we realized that that was a huge barrier for our community and thinking about careers and thinking about pursuing education, because the majority of our community are on high-cost biologics and prescription medicines. So we're focused on three policy priorities within prescription drugs. And I should say that we do some advocacy on behalf of, or not on behalf of, but for other industries like PBMs and insurers. But we're really focused on prescription drugs because we feel like that's an area that addresses the fundamental cause of a lot of access and affordability challenges in our community. So the way we have this sort of structured is through our preclinical, which is we're focused on the patent system, which I'll touch on very briefly, the clinical stage, which is clinical trials, and then post-market, which is pharma marketing. And I'll explain each of these areas and why we're addressing each of these areas very briefly. So essentially, our work in patent reform is focused on reducing the over-patenting of prescription medicines. And so oftentimes people ask us, why are you in the patent space? It seems really random. And for us, it is truly a root cause as to why we see our drug prices so high. So unfortunately, the patent system has been abused to prevent competition and to prevent more timely access to biosimilars and generics, which are cheaper versions of our high-cost biologics and small molecules. And so we have worked significantly on legislation and with the Food and Drug Administration and the United States Patent and Trademark Office to try to get bad patents really out the door and to try to make sure that when we're patenting a prescription medicine, that it's not done in a way to disincentivize these cheaper versions of therapeutics to come to market. Our work in clinical trials is really focused on the need to disaggregate data for young adults, because right now we see a lot of trials aggregate data as 18 to 60, for example, or 18 to 64. And one of our goals is to try to get more public reporting of young adults in trials as 18 to 26 or 27 to 35, for example. And so that's our policy priority in clinical trials. And then pharma direct-to-consumer advertising on social media. We, unfortunately, the FDA, which the Food and Drug Administration, which oversees prescription medication advertisements on social media, is way, way, way behind on their oversight of advertisements on Meta or Instagram and TikTok. And so we worked very closely on the first legislation to address the increasing false and misleading advertisements on Meta and TikTok with Senators Durbin and Braun. One of the things that I think is the most exciting about our health policy work is that everything we do at Generation Patient is community-led, but is that we are really trying to inform and I think educate our community to be driving health policy rather than just be a part of it. And I think that's a big distinguishing factor that I hope that more advocacy groups and more people in general can think about is that we don't want to just be sharing our narratives, which are very important, but we want to be envisioning what the policy and what the solutions look like. And I'm really proud of our community. I mean, they create all these educational videos on very technical topics that most people don't think that we can understand or grasp due to age and experience, and they're educating the rest of our community to be sharing these insights. So on our website, we have a bunch of videos on young adult patients talking about really key policy issues and ones that are quite underaddressed within the health policy space in general. And this is just a picture of me and Peyton at the White House, where we spoke about President Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, which allowed Medicare to negotiate drug prices for the first time. So we, as I mentioned, we really believe in this idea of patient-led movements. I won't go through this too much, or maybe I already did, but I think I talked about the patent system. I think for the sake of time, I'm going to probably skip out on a couple of these slides, but really the purpose of the patent system for us is to encourage and incentivize new drugs and new treatments. However, we often see that other companies who want to create these medications cannot do so until the patent expires, and that means that in the United States, we end up waiting years and years for these biosimilars and generics, which creates major access barriers for us. An example, one of the most notorious examples was Humira, produced by AbbVie. AbbVie, one of the notable things I think, and many in our community were on Humira, including myself, also known as adalimumab. However, we saw a really, really delayed launch of biosimilars of adalimumab in the United States. And what's really prolific about this case is that AbbVie patented Humira, I think, over 100 times after the initial FDA approval. And there were patents on things like the color of the pen or just things that are quite irrelevant to the actual use case of the therapeutic. And so we submitted testimony to Congress on this and have been slowly trying to prevent potential similar cases of the patent abuse that AbbVie was able to accomplish, which prevented our community from accessing therapeutics in a more timely way. So some of the legislative education that we worked on, the way that we do this is we go directly to staffers who are part of Senate Judiciary and the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. And we try to educate both staffers on both sides of the aisle. And patent reform happens to be very bipartisan, which we're just very lucky for right now. But there's a few different issues that we work on, which I won't go into right now, but I'm happy to explain any of these at some point in the future. But one of the big areas that we're focused on is patent thickets, which is basically when a company will create a big web of patents to try to prevent any sort of modification by a generic or biosimilar drug company as they're coming to market. And so these are areas that our community collectively identified and areas that we'll be working toward this upcoming year. Another big one that we really try to do, which is, I think, a more accessible policy area, is increasing public engagement in the patent system. So we really believe that within all regulatory agencies, especially now, it's very important for the public to be able to have transparent and accessible opportunities to engage with decisions that these regulators are making. And so we, within all of our advocacy priorities, whether that's working with the FDA, PTO, the NIH, one of our goals is to try to create more lines of communication to the public and to groups like ours who are affected directly by some of these decisions. Oh, by the way, all of these graphics are drawn by our community members too. So just wanted to flag that. I forgot to mention that. I always try to mention that, but forgot to mention it this time. So moving on to our work in the clinical trial space. So I mentioned a little bit about the intention behind this, but this has been, I think, the most interesting policy area for us to try to formulate a solution around, because they're again, global bodies just have not defined young adults very well, and there's very differing definitions. And sometimes we're grouped with adolescents or just lumped in with adults and older adults. And so we are starting to work on this issue internationally, because countries beyond the US are a little bit more progressive on the way that they're thinking about trial inclusion and data disaggregation for age. But yes, so I mentioned that already. So there's a big lack of consensus, as I mentioned. So as you can see, there's just differing age groups. And then for the over 18 demographic, it's almost difficult to even imagine us as a separate subgroup within these agencies. And just so you all know, we've done a lot of research too on some of the multidisciplinary reviews at the FDA. And by research, I mean we just have been digging into it. We haven't done any systematic studies, but we know that for certain therapeutics, there is a different response, for the under 35 demographic. And so this is just a case example of vedolizumab for ulcerative colitis, or I guess in this case, Crohn's disease. And so we have some like building evidence that we have, but it's really just up to, I think, one, defining the consensus, and two, being able to then get pharma companies, but also regulatory agencies to mandate the public disclosure of subgrouped age data. We also see that, now this is focus on adverse event reporting, but we also see this issue similarly when we're thinking about post-market adverse events. So right now, 18 to 64 is grouped as one demographic in the FDA adverse event reporting system, and CDC somehow has figured out a better age data to say disaggregation to 18 to 29, for example. So you just see this lack of consistency that we're trying to address. And the way that we're starting to work on policy related to this, we did so a couple of years ago on legislation, specifically related to diversity in trials. But we're trying to work with global agencies to, one, define our community better, and then two, create guidance on what appropriate disaggregation would look like. So the last area that I'm going to touch on, I think I only have 7 minutes or so, which I think I should be able to finish. But I wanted to share this case study because I think this is an example of the way that we really hope that we can be seen as people with lived experience within policy spaces or within the healthcare system as general, as drivers of what reform can look like. And so last, or a couple of years ago, our community areas or our community members started to identify influencers advertising prescription medicines as though they were quick fixes or just things that, were not serious chemical compounds. And so we started to notice, especially the influx of micro-influencers or influencers who have like 10,000, 15,000 followers, being sponsored by pharma companies to really promote these prescription medications to influencers and followers. And we felt very concerned because in a lot of these advertisements, we didn't see the full story of these prescription medicines. So we didn't see safety information displayed in a way that we could identify or understand the potential safety implications. A lot of the language that was used around safety was very high level and didn't take into account the potential like contraindications with certain therapeutics like Zofran and cardiac conditions. And so we started to do some digging at the Food and Drug Administration, which oversees these prescription medication advertisements. And we realized that they were, over 10 years behind on guidance for companies advertising on Meta and TikTok. And we started to see just some preliminary awareness. So, for example, workshop at the Duke-Margolis Center for Health Policy highlighted vulnerable populations, which we don't really like to use the word vulnerable, but for the purposes of this, vulnerable populations is adolescents and those with chronic health conditions. But again, we just didn't see any sort of action or movement of solutions for this issue. And we saw the creativity of these advertisements, follow trends on TikTok that were just very unserious and not very objective as to the important and serious nature of these prescription medicines. So while the FDA has discretion over the advertisements, they updated their guidance a few months ago last year after 10 years of putting out their first guidance. And we believe that that's because of some of the pressure that the senators we worked with put on FDA to try to increase oversight of these ads. And they had not held a public workshop since 2009. And one thing to note is that social media is changing so fast that the ways that these prescription medications are being advertised, the comment sections, the direct messages, there's just very little regulation and oversight of these sort of opportunities for micro interactions. So, for example, this is an advertisement, just one example, which I've of course blurred out the names of these people, but you see advertisements and the comment sections are quite scary. I think this one is probably not the best example, but you see, people interacting in these comment sections and influencers who are sponsoring saying you won't regret, trying this medication, for example. And so seeing these big gaps in oversight and regulation, and then you see like New York Fashion Week and Nurtec ODT. And I think, for us as young adult patients too, we just felt the urgency to address this because we all rely on life-saving therapeutics. I mean, I've been on prescription medication since I was 6 years old, but they also very much come with adverse events and just things that are less than ideal alongside their efficacy. And so to advertise this in a way where it becomes a fashion statement or where it becomes just a trend feels very misleading to those of us who are taking these prescription medicines. This is an example just of it's not a video because I always get scared to play videos on presentations. They never work for me, but this is an example of a 7 second viral ad that now has actually nearly 1 million likes. This was a couple of years ago and over 200 million views and has no safety information anywhere. And just, shares how easy it is to get access to this therapeutic. So what we did is we started to draft recommendations, and we published an opinion editorial in Stat News with a professor at Dartmouth, Stephen Voloshin, and we came up with some of the recommendations that we had as a patient group. And then we were contacted by Senator Durbin's office to formulate essentially a letter that would go to FDA Commissioner Califf. And we were really excited because the letter, really included the unique lens of the impact on young people, and the fact that a lot of these regulation, the lack of oversight was harming our community in a disproportionate way due to our social media usage. So that oversight letter happened last year at around this time, and Upon receiving responses from that letter, we worked on drafting legislation with Senator Durbin in Braun's office, and it included many of the recommendations that our community had. And this legislation was just reintroduced this congressional session by Senator Durbin and Marshall. So it is bipartisan, which again is very helpful to have during these times. But we were able to get a lot of public awareness on this issue as well because of the major gaps in oversight, which was really exciting because I think when we think about legislation, we also think about the importance of public awareness and public education on a lot of on these issues. We have a whole website that talks a little bit more about this legislation and just a couple of takeaways. I know I think I'm at time now, but I just want to say I think there's no one right way and to engage in systems change. There's so many issues that I think touch the medical setting and the hospital setting that have an impact on us as we transition and transfer into adulthood. I think lived experience is the most powerful form of experience for meaningful change. We see a lot of times that we are seen, especially as patients, as a problem to be solved, but we really hope that we're seen more so as partners and leaders in creating what this change looks like. Another thing is I think there's various ways to engage people with lived experience, and it's about finding the right tools, resources, and people to do so. For us, I mean, we work on, especially in the patent space, on very technical topics, and they're not intuitive to us, but we found a way to understand them and to try to translate that back to our experiences with access and affordability. And then the last thing is just because I know there's a lot of researchers and healthcare professionals on this call, is that we need a greater evidence base, and researchers and healthcare professionals can be incredible allies for the implementation of community-identified research gaps. So we really do rely on the expertise of so many of you all, and there's such a great opportunity to co-design research questions and outcomes with people with lived experience too. So I think that is all for me. That's my contact information, and yes, happy to answer any questions.
Sneha, thank you so very much for a wonderful description of the work that you do, especially informing us on patent abuse, deceptive drug advertising, as well as how to make medications more accessible to those who need them. And you've probably noticed there are many very positive reactions in the chat, but I'm going to segue on to the first question, which is, does Generation Patient help organizations wanting to build teen advisory boards of young adults with chronic health conditions?
Yeah, so we do some sort of consulting with that, but that's not our main area. And I would also say that we have a little bit of a less emphasis on teenagers and a little bit more on the 18 to 30, 35 demographic. However, I think we have lots of people in our community that would be willing to help with that. So yeah, we have an amazing close group of people at Generation Patient that often will advise on various projects. So that's definitely something that we or people in our community would be open to.
Thank you.
Mic drop. Thank you so much. You're getting a lot of appreciation in the chat for your intelligence and your political sophistication and your policy work. So good. I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit more about the caregiver roles that you're finding people taking on as we have more people in the country in general of all ages living with chronic illnesses and post-COVID. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the challenges that we're seeing, and we don't really have a solution to this, but we're, I think, trying to closely follow what can be done, is that, more and more of our community members are taking on that caregiver role for their parents while also managing a chronic health condition. And so we don't, I mean, we'd be open to learning more actually about this issue from a policy perspective, but we know there's organizations addressing the role of young caregivers, but maybe not so much young caregivers with chronic illness and the impact that can have on their ability to, I guess, thrive into adulthood themselves. But yeah, I can't tell you how many young people in our community have become caregivers for their parents who have Alzheimer's, for example, or ALS. So it's definitely something we don't have a solution to, but are trying to understand more of the challenge for right now.
So another very specific question, which is whether you will be you're ready to receive referrals from the IDD community.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if you know, we've actually had conversations about this internally as to how we can create even more accessible groups. Right now, our groups are actually at capacity, so we are trying to figure out how we can do more than 6 meetings per month, because we are going to have to start, unfortunately, turning people away, which we never would want to do. But we try to keep these groups less than 10 people just because of the nature of them. But I would love to connect with you on that more too, because we're definitely very interested in creating a space that can be even more accessible than the ones currently. And so, yeah, probably not yet for referrals, but if you have any ideas, I would be really excited to chat with you.
Thank you. We had a question about how is your organization funded?
Yeah, so we have funding from private foundations such as the Helmsley Charitable Trust, the Commonwealth Fund, Arnold Ventures, and a couple of other groups. And we've had to get very creative because we don't take pharma or insurance or PBM money. And so that really puts us at a position of having to think about how we can always get funding sources. I will say one of the things that we have just started actually this week is our mutual aid program. So we are now seeking donations from individuals for that, because a lot of foundations won't cover mutual aid. And for those of you who don't know what mutual aid is, it's essentially a tool, or not a tool, but a way that we can give funds directly to our community, because so many in our community are struggling right now to afford food, just basic necessities. And so we're giving out something called grocery grants to our community members in order to try to help in the way that we can at this time. I also want to note that, I know this was not the question, but we do compensate everyone who's part of our community, and we believe that's very crucial to increasing access and just the ability for people to advocate. So I do encourage you all to try to build that in robustly into your budgets too, because I think you'll get a lot more of a range of folks with experiences if that payment is built in. So we do try to make that as part of our grant proposals and everything that we do.
A question about data disaggregation. I mean, it looks like it's a big issue because you can't, if you don't have the data, you don't know what the prevalence, incidence, et cetera. And are we still at the stage where we're dependent on large federal agencies who collect data to disaggregate? Or are we also looking to sort of smaller efforts, maybe at the state levels, to try to get this data?
That's a great question. We have investigated this a bit, I think, in New York, but haven't found a lot of success in trying to find the right people. So if anybody has better ideas for state level data disaggregation, that would be great. But I think our intention specifically for this is for clinical trials, although, I mean, data disaggregation needs to happen for, you know, most issues that are impacting our community. But we've tried to go to pharmaceutical companies, but we haven't gotten a lot of traction because I think it makes it harder for them. Also, we don't know how many of our community members are actually enrolled in these trials. And so I think there would be a hesitation for some trials where we probably know there's an under-enrollment of the 18 to 26 demographic to disaggregate that data. But I think that's also an opportunity because we know that for conditions like IBD, the peak onset is now in adolescence. And so, you know, we're transitioning into adulthood. And so it's crucial to capture this age demographic, I think, more than ever now. So.
Okay, thank you.
I'm wondering if you have more information on the data sources where you're getting your numbers for your prevalence, what are the sources and what are the sources that you need?
Yeah, so base source that we found is from the CDC, although it's from 2019, so it's not great data. And then we did some calculation because the CDC in 2019 estimated that I think over half, maybe like 52% or something like that, of young adults ages 18 to 34 live with at least one chronic condition. However, they included anxiety and depression, like on their own as chronic conditions, and we address more like chronic health conditions in addition, of course, to anxiety and depression that comes along with a lot of these conditions. And so we did some calculation based off that to remove just like to try to get more of the chronic health conditions. But I think that it would be great if the CDC estimated or we looked at that data, because I imagine it's a little bit larger of a number now than in 2019 too. So.
Well, thank you so very much for your presentation. We all feel like we've learned, you know, some amazing things that we weren't aware of, and sort of more room and space for advocacy. So thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Yes. Do you have anything else you'd like to share with the group?
No, not really, but we have a monthly newsletter that you can subscribe to, where we share some of our updates, and we're starting a roundtable series on young adults with chronic conditions that is starting at the end of March, where we invite about 20 people from different stakeholder groups to participate in this, and then we will publish our findings after. So if anybody's interested in getting involved in that, I can actually put my, I don't know if I'm able to, I can put my email in the chat, and if you'd like to get involved with that, we'd love to have some of you all, especially from geographically diverse areas too, because that's something that we're passionate about increasing our, I think, programming too as well. So
well, I think the content of what you're doing is incredibly important, but also your role modeling of how to be an effective advocate in this environment, and how just the role modeling of how to use data, how to use relationships with legislators, how to set an agenda, how to back it up. A lot of us are sitting back saying, oh, the environment's gotten so bad, we don't know what to do. And then you come on and show us how it's done. So thank you for that. We're really grateful for you being here today.
No, thank you all for your work. And I'm really excited to learn from the rest of this conference too. So
you've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.